Hi, Odyssey fans. I'm Jesse, editor of Focus on the Family Clubhouse Magazine.
And I'm Bob, producer of the Adventures in Odyssey Club. Welcome to the official Adventures in Odyssey podcast.
Coming up on the podcast, we're taking a deep dive into the recent episode, The Christmas Bells.
This episode has gotten a lot of fans talking about the story, the music, and especially about a revelation at the end of the episode.
Which means that it's time once again to issue a huge spoiler warning. If you haven't heard The Christmas Bells, stop listening to this podcast and listen to it now.
It's available in the club as a download and on CD, or you can listen free for the next few days at adventuresinodyssey.com. And if you're still fumbling for the stop button, we'll give you a second before we do any spoilers.
They're gone, right, Bob?
Well, we've given them plenty of warning. But one last one. If you're still listening and you haven't heard The Christmas Bells, well, you're about to hear that episode discussed in spoilerific detail.
So let's get right into it. Here's the team behind the episode, writer-director Phil Lawler, sound designer Nathan Jones, and composer John Campbell. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Howdy. How you doing, boys?
Hi, Jesse.
It's great having everybody together. But Phil, I do want to start with you. So if you look at history, there are literally millions of stories that you could tell in Odyssey. So how did you come across the story of Longfellow, and why did you decide that that would make a good one to tell?
Well, you come across story ideas in a variety of ways. Everything that I read in the newspapers or online or watch on television, or if I'm just driving, you know, around, writers are kind of like people who kind of have antennae all over them, and they're looking for good stories. They're always looking for something good to tell, to explore story wise. And I was just literally just perusing the internet one day, and I came across this the story of Longfellow. I always liked Longfellow's poetry. I really like the Neil Diamond song, Longfellow Serenade. That's a wonderful song. And I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. And I knew that he was was around the time of the Civil War, which is another real interest of mine. I really am a big Civil War fan. And then the story just kind of presented itself. I didn't know all of the details behind. I knew he had written the Christmas Bells poem. And I knew that that had turned into the carol that we sing, which is I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. Did some research on it, fleshed it out, and now we have it on Odyssey.
You know, in addition to the Longfellow historical story, there's something afoot in present-day Odyssey. So why is Wilson so spiritually distressed?
Well, you know, we've kind of played with this notion in the past that there are certain people in Odyssey who have a deeper insight into spiritual awareness. Jack was very much like this. Wit has been very much like this. And now Wilson is also very much like this, which is really interesting if you know anything about Wilson's past. If you've listened to the episodes or read some of the Young Wit books, you realize what a real character Wilson has been. He hasn't been what you would call an enormously spiritual guy in the past, but now he's sort of awakened spiritually, and he has this kind of revelation, it's very vague, it's not real specific. And so they're trying to put this message together with some of the things that are going on in and around Odyssey, and it all plays out later on in a really wonderful way. And that's all I'll say about it. I want people to listen. But
right, and we know that this story will continue into another episode. And again, we don't want to get into any spoilers for that one. But tell us why you decided to begin a story arc with a historical episode. Was that always your plan?
No, it actually wasn't. I really liked the story itself, the historical story itself, I thought just stood on its own. And I was really, really interested in the poetry angle of it. And it really, poetry is a very, very wonderful way to get an insight into the ethereal world. And so Wilson was definitely that kind of conduit. So I wasn't really thinking in terms of connecting the two spiritual things together, the spiritual thing, the insight, the revelation with this story. But then I talked to Marshall, and we knew we were going to be doing a certain kind of story arc, and we pondered it, and we went back and forth, and we thought, how can we do that? What would that take? What would that look like? And then it ended up working out really, really well. And so it's really nice. Those are just on an even different spiritual plane for us as writers and creators of this program. That's when I look and say, that's the Holy Spirit at work. That's the Holy Spirit working on Odyssey completely. I really love that aspect of it.
One of Three Will Fall, and we will find out what that means in album 71. John Campbell, let's move on to the musical elements of this episode. You're usually not involved until after a show is recorded. Musicals are a little bit different, though. What work did you do before recording?
I remember when we first started, Phil and I had a conversation, and he kind of talked to me and explained to me what he wanted to convey with the story, but also musically, because there are different scenes. The Longfellow poem actually has more verses than what we normally hear. And Phil wanted to explore that. But he wanted to explore it within a scene and what was going on at the time. So some of the verses were light, but a couple of the verses were very dark, going on during the Civil War time. So I kind of sat down and I started just playing a piano, a rough piano track, and then sang each of the verses based on the script as a kind of a template that I could send to Greg and he could practice that. So that's how we kind of got started with that. But I had already kind of thought through how I wanted to do each, there were probably five or six different takes throughout the show of different verses. And so I kind of had to think through how I wanted to approach that musically, because when it came back, once it comes back to me, I needed to orchestrate over what I had done.
And Greg is such an amazing singer, I don't have a musical bone in my body. So for those like me who are listening and are not familiar with music, why is finding the right key so important? And even that whole major, minor scale, I mean, I guess one's more positive and one's emotes different feelings in a listener.
Well, here's my question. Have you ever been to like a worship service, church service, and they're doing the worship, and singing, but somehow the lead singer or the worship leader starts some hymn off in a key that is so high or so low, nobody can sing it.
I've been there. Yes.
We all have. And, this is the first thing that I think. Once I, kind of figure out what I want to do, I needed to know Greg's vocal range for any singing. In fact, I remember when on any of the shows, the latest one, even last year when we did like California Dreams, Jules was singing, a song. But I had to connect with the actor who's singing these things and kind of find out their vocal range so that I was staying within their range. It just makes a lot more sense to figure out that before they go in and try to sing tracks that are so high or so low, it makes no sense whatsoever. But on the other side of that, I wanted to make sure that it had enough of a push. Like on the last stanza at the very end of the Christmas Bell show, it is kind of the payoff last verse of the carol. Greg is singing it. And so I wanted it to be high enough where he had to kind of push it to give it energy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want it to be so high he was crackling, but not so low that he couldn't really push it out. And so I had to kind of work that in so to make sure that I knew he could get to it. And he obviously did. It came out fantastic. He did such a wonderful job with it.
Greg Jabara was in the studio along with engineer Christopher Deal, but Phil, you were directing by computer. And so what were some of the other challenges that you encountered as a result of that related to the singing?
Well, it's always better, I think, if we're all together in the studio. But of course, because of COVID and all the things that are going on in the world right now, we couldn't do that. This was recorded at a time when they were allowing certain numbers of people into the studio, limited number of people in the studio, and Greg was one of them. He came in at that point. He hadn't gone to New York yet because, you know, he goes to New York to record Blue Bloods. He was there in California, and Chris was there, like you said. And it actually, to me, in some ways, it makes you more focused. If you're there in the studio, you're kind of doing a lot of different things and you're aware of different stuff that's going on around you. But in this instance, all I had to do was really focus on Greg and his performance. And so as a director, that really kind of helped out a lot. There are some technical challenges, obviously, dropouts and things like that. And I didn't hear what somebody said. And you want to be able to talk to the production engineer sometimes without the actors hearing, because you have to make certain adjustments. And you can't really do that when you're recording remotely. It's difficult to do that. But overall, I think that it's been a fairly seamless transition for me as a director to record remotely versus being in the studio. We've done this now for a year, and it's actually been quite interesting and quite fun. And I'm a real homebody anyway, so I'm kind of gratified about the fact that, you know, my commute lasts 30 seconds. I go from my kitchen into my into my office. And but on the other hand, we miss the camaraderie. I mean, I really miss the people and getting together with the people, just like everybody in the world is missing getting together with people in groups. And hopefully, Lord willing, that will end soon and we'll all be able to get together and have a wonderful big mask burning party somewhere.
Amen to that.
That's right.
You know, Jesse, we actually do have three guests in the studio or with us today. One of them is to your right.
Sitting right here.
He's been very patient.
Hi.
Hey, Nate.
Nathan Jones, the sound designer on this episode. Nate, you've said this episode has four delivery systems, whereas most Odyssey episodes only have one. What does that mean exactly, and how did it affect production?
Well, most of the time when we hear Odyssey, we are in the world of Odyssey. And we do break that sometimes when we get in the imagination station and stuff like that. And we have a real indicator as to traveling in a different period or a different time. But this one was different because it had four. And so it takes place in Odyssey, and then it goes back in history. And not only does it have history, it's got musical, and then finally poetry. And all four of those have to have their space and their proper attention given to each to make them work and to have them kind of weave in and out. So that was really different about this one. And production-wise, I've said it before, anytime you have a period piece in history, you're automatically handcuffed into no modern technologies.
Right.
So you can't just, grab sounds that we would hear every day. You have to watch out for that stuff and make sure that it, follows the rules. So, four delivery systems right there in one show. Thanks,
wow.
Phil.
Yeah, it's the writer's fault or benefit.
Anything I can do to help you out there, Nate? Anything I can do to help you out?
Going back to the music for a second, after it was recorded in the studio, and of course you talked about multiple takes of each verse from the song, how do you go about creating the final songs from there? And did you approach it differently here than other musicals that you've produced?
When John provides the temp track that that Greg would sing to, that is brought back into the show so that when John gets it, all of the original lengths and tempos and start times are all existing in the show so that when John can make his score blend into the things that now he had the foresight as to what he was going to do.
Yeah.
And so now that provides the bridge and the index for him to score and marry that to.
Wow. This is more complicated than I ever imagined it was going to be. But obviously you guys do a lot of back and forth, John and Nate, between you on any given episode, really, talking about music cues and so on. How was the back and forth process of creating this story's music a little different?
Because of the four delivery systems, you've got John that's now going to be responsible for four different palettes. Right, John?
That is correct. So talk about that, John.
Yeah. Let me go back, because obviously before any show,
whoever's producing it. In this case, Nate and I had some conversations about how he wanted to approach some of the underscore, because besides the music, the Christmas bell songs that Greg was singing, there was a lot of underscore that went through that. And Nate had kind of dialed in on some areas that he wanted certain types of music, kind of an ethereal piece that kind of ran through some of Longfellow's thinking to himself about what was going on in life. In terms of the songs, once Nate put all that together, he would send me the track with the singing in it already. And since I had the pre-tracks, I was able to line up kind of what I had done and then deliver the what we call the stems, which would be the music track and perhaps maybe a couple of effects or a solo instrument that I'd be doing. And so I can get that back to Nate so he would know how to kind of lock it in. And it all sounds seamless, but it's in a way, it is kind of how we've done it so many times before. Nate and I and Jonathan Crowe, Chris Deal, you know, we've all worked together for so many years on so many projects. We kind of have learned to kind of understand each other, how we assemble, you know, these types of shows.
You don't hear the word ethereal that much anymore. But John, you just used that word, and it was also used in some of the stage direction from the recording script. And so Nate,
right.
I know in this one particular section, it says, as Wilson begins describing his prayer time at the beginning, the script says, a subtle ethereal supernatural effect rises under, as Wilson explains, the same effect comes up under each poem. Mm-hmm. So what did that stage direction mean to you, and how did you turn that into the sound design?
Well, I think that starts with Phil having the foresight to know that you can't just plunge an audience into a quote-unquote ethereal thing or something that's supernatural without them having a head jerk, and then you've lost them for the show because they've got to rewind and try and figure out what it is that you're doing. So obviously, when I saw the script and I saw that there were just going to be pieces that I was going to need to get clarification on, so I would call Phil and I'd say, Phil, you know, what exactly are you hearing and what's your intention and what are you thinking? You know, when you started writing this, what did you want to convey? Because my job is to tell the story on the sound side of it. And so if I don't do that, then I haven't done my job. So I call Phil and I say, Phil, you know, what does this mean? What does that mean? And I think what really set it off was Phil's description of that sleepy, dreamy prayer time. Right, Phil?
Yeah, I think that's true. Interestingly enough, a lot of the times when I write scripts, I go back to, this is going to sound really lofty, and I don't mean it to, but I go back to the Shakespearean idea of story writing, which is he didn't describe anything. He just gave dialogue. You know, and a lot of times I just do that too. I won't really explain a whole lot in my scripts. I won't really give a whole lot of explanation of here's what we need and here's what I want and here's what I'm doing. And the reason why is because we have some of the best sound designers in the world here. And one of them we're talking to here with Nate. And I really want to give them as much leeway as possible. I don't want to tell them what to do. I really would much rather they use their unbelievable creativity to come up with their own ideas of this of what we should be hearing. But interestingly enough, I handed in the first draft of this script for the team to look at. They didn't really like it, and the reason they didn't like it is because I didn't have that kind of description in it. So they weren't getting what was going on with me at all. I was like really, really into it, but they weren't hearing in the script or even reading as they were reading through the script. They weren't getting it at all. And so I went back and said, okay, obviously this is going to have to be something different. I'm going to have to take a different approach. And so I really did go back then and say, all right, I'm going to have to explain. I'm going to have to really, really detail what I'm looking for here as best as I can in words. And so that's where, you know, a subtle ethereal supernatural effect rises under, as Wilson explains his prayer time. And then I realized that that's going to have to come under each of these poems. And then it's and then I do remember saying in the script saying each verse needs to build on the last one musically. So the first one's very simple. The second one's a little more complex musically. The third one's more. And by the time you get to that last verse, we're full blown orchestral boom, boom, boom. It's big. It's unbelievable. And then comes back down very rapidly to a very simple ending coming out of the songs. And so, again, these gentlemen are brilliant at doing that.
Phil, if I could actually add to what you were saying, when we started this, the Bells of Christmas was playing on a little music box. And the first time Wilson played to the music box, but as the story progressed and we got into the story, then it built, as you say. And now, of course, it just hit me. I remember because it put hairs on the back of my neck when I did it. The last verse that was sung, it was big and orchestral and sweeping, but it fell back down into the antique shop with the music box playing. And that's how it kind of ended. It was really wonderful. There's those moments for me, you know, I think sometimes when you write so much music or you write so many scripts, there are rare moments when it just hits you like this is really something special. And that was a special moment for me. I really, really love that.
Me too. I think that was one really, you have certain things that you remember. Greg's performance in this, when he went back and forth, is just stunning. It's so good. I wish he were here. I wish we could talk to him about it too, because he was just unbelievable in the way first of all, the way he just followed the directions, but secondly, the way he just brought so much more to those poems that it was really a special recording session.
He made Longfellow sound good, is what you're saying, Phil.
Yeah. I mean, just not just good, fantastic, great. I mean, it was spectacular. He's really good.
Nate, with so much going on in this episode, was there one particular moment that was especially challenging? May or may not have had anything to do with the music.
I think it was how to lift the poetry sections up. There's something about designing a bit of sound design and having things work. Because I don't want to give it away either, but there are sections where Longfellow he's obviously reading this poetry and we hear the sound of that. And we wanted to make that a nice, rich voice that sounded really up close and personal and intimate. But what that allows you to do is to play things underneath of it to help carry along or create an image or to help your mind kind of place what's going on. And for me, I think those are the challenging bits. You know, it's much more difficult than having someone walk through a door, shut the door, sit down. Hi, how's it going, everybody? That's what we do every day.
Well, Jesse, after this conversation, I can't help but want to go back and listen to Christmas Bells all over again.
Right?
You pick up on some of these subtle things that that just were so seamlessly put together, and it was so enjoyable that we didn't really think about the process. But now, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to unpack that for us a little bit.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, really great stuff, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
I just love these deep dive podcasts. You know, it's so interesting to see how much thought and effort goes into a single episode. I'm excited and a little worried, honestly, to see where this series goes. It sounds like there's plenty ahead.
Indeed. And this isn't the only storyline moving forward right now. This weekend, we hear the next episode in the Maury, Suzu, Emily arc. Things reached a fever pitch last album with the Rydell Revelations, and this story picks up the pieces.
Let's hear a preview.
Next time on Adventures in Odyssey, Emily Jones is sentenced to detention.
That phone you took isn't mine.
It seems to be a simple misunderstanding until Emily sees the other kids in detention.
Maury, Suzu, what are you doing here?
Is this Maury and Suzu's latest scheme? Or is it something bigger?
We have a bona fide mystery.
Solve it yourself on the next Adventure in Odyssey.
You can hear Let's Call the Whole Thing Off on the radio and online this weekend. And you can hear all 6 episodes in Album 70, Finding a Way, in the club on CD and download.
But for now, that's all for this edition of the official Adventures in Odyssey podcast, a presentation of Focus on the Family.
Join the club at AIOclub.org.
Or check out the website at AdventuresInOdyssey.com.
Or if you care to talk to someone in person at Focus, call 1-800-A-FAMILY. I'm Bob.
And I'm Jesse, reminding you that with God in your life, every day is an adventure.